Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 48.
The sources paint this picture of the villagers involved in a yearly ritual, a very serious one.
Yeah, they're at the Lingen Temple. The name itself means something like spiritually responsive temple. And the ritual is, well, it's meticulously done. Village elders are leading it, big offerings.
But the offerings are heavy.
Oh, incredibly so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just pigs and sheep. The truly heartbreaking part is they're sacrificing two children, a boy, Chen Guanbao, and a girl, Chen Yichenjin.
Wow. And who are they making the sacrifice to? It's a being called the spiritually responsive great king.
All right. But here's the thing. There's no statue, no image of this king at all. Just a golden plaque in the temple with the name written on it.
That's interesting. No actual god figure to look at.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right away, it makes you wonder, well, what is this king? Because there's no defined image. It could be, well, anything exploiting that belief.
And what are the villagers praying for?
Oh, it's basic survival stuff. Good weather, good harvest. So you see this direct, desperate link between this horrible offering and just making it through the year.
So they do the whole ceremony, burn the paper offerings, and then they just leave the children there, alone.
They leave them, which, of course, is where our heroes come in.
Ah, right. Two of the travelers have actually swapped places with the kids.
Exactly. A classic bit of cleverness from the group.
It sounds like Pigsy is maybe having second thoughts once the coast is clear. He suggests they should just bolt, go home.
Yeah, Pigsy's definitely nervous. But Monkey King, he's absolutely firm. The text really highlights his resolve here. He's like, no, we agreed to this. We have to see it through.
Why, though? They saved the kids, didn't they?
Well, Monkey's point is, if they just trick the demon this time and run, what happens next year? Mm. Or what if the demon takes revenge on the village? He thinks just running is foolish talk, as the text puts it. They need to actually deal with the threat, not just avoid it for a night.
So even though Pigsy's probably sweating bullets, they stay. They wait.
They wait. And then the atmosphere changes, the wind picks up.
Yeah, the sources describe it with this whooshing sound.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And Pigsy recognizes that sound instantly. It scares him. He knows what it means.
And that sound announces the arrival, and the being that appears at the temple door, definitely not your friendly neighborhood deity.
Not even close.
Yeah.
The description we get is really striking, kind of contradictory. He looks impressive at first glance. Golden armor, golden helmet, this belt like red clouds wrapped around him, bright eyes like stars.
But then you see the teeth, jagged, like sought teeth.
Exactly. That contrast right there tells you everything. Power, yes, but predatory. Dangerous.
There are other details too, right? About his aura.
Yeah, like smoke and mist around his feet, a sort of warm, oppressive energy where he stands. But then this chilling yin wind when he actually moves. It's all very unsettling. He sort of resembles a powerful guardian figure, which is probably part of the disguise.
So he comes in and talks to the child who's Monkey King in disguise.
Right. And Monkey answers back, clearly, articulately. And this seems to throw the demon off.
Why is that?
Because usually the kids are paralyzed with fear. They can't speak. So this articulate child makes him suspicious immediately.
He keeps questioning, asks their names.
Yeah, he presses them. Monkey gives the names Chen Guanbao and Yiching Jin. And then the demon just lays it out. I'm here to eat you. It's the annual custom.
And this is where Pigsy messes up.
Sort of. It's actually a bit darkly funny. The demon muses about maybe eating the girl first this year, or maybe the boy. And Pigsy, who's disguised as the girl, gets so nervous he blurts out something like, hey, stick to the usual order.
Oh, Pigsy.
Haha, yeah. Well, that interruption is all the demon needs. He decides to just grab Pigsy right then and there.
And that's when the masks come off.
Literally. Both Monkey and Pigsy instantly reveal their true forms.
And Pigsy jumps straight into action.
He does. No hesitation now. Attacks with his nine-toothed rake. And the source mentions this loud dang sound as it hits the demon's armor.
Revealing fish scales.
Big round fish scales underneath the armor. That's the giveaway. And Monkey gets it immediately.
Instantly. He yells, catch up! They realize this isn't just a ground brawl. They leap up.
And the monster, it seems kind of surprised.
Yeah, apparently wasn't expecting anyone to actually hit it physically. Didn't even bring a weapon. It calls out, like, who are you guys messing up my sacrifice?
And Monkey, ever the diplomat.
He just lays it out straight, tells them they're monks from the Tang Empire heading west for scriptures.
Heard about this evil creature eating kids.
Mm-hmm. And they're here to save the locals and capture him.
He even demands the monster pay back the lives of the children he's eaten.
Mm.
Pretty intense.
It really is. So the monster, hearing this basically declaration of war,
he decides it's time to go.
makes a strategic exit. Pigsy tries another swing, but nope.
Because the monster does what?
Transforms into, like, a gust of wind.
Okay.
And just vanishes straight into the Tung Tian River.
And Monkey decides not to follow him into the water.
Smart move, yeah. Monkey knows fighting underwater isn't his strong suit, especially against a creature native to it. He decides, okay, let's regroup. We need to figure out how to catch this thing tomorrow because we still need to get the master across this river. That's the main goal.
Right. So they head back to the village.
Back to the Chen family home. And you can imagine the scene there, the Tang monk, Sandy, the family, all waiting, probably terrified.
And Monkey and Pigsy just walk in.
Pretty much. They apparently just drop the sacrificial food items they were meant to replace in the courtyard and explain everything that happened. Huge relief all around, obviously. The family's incredibly grateful.
But meanwhile, down in the river,
yeah,
the demon's not happy.
No, he's furious. Back in his underwater palace, his subjects can see he's fuming. He complains about losing his meal, getting roughed up, and how this whole thing has ruined his reputation, cut off his supply of sacrifices. It's a disaster for him. But then his motivation shifts.
This is the big one, right? The Tang monk rumor.
Exactly. He mentions hearing this rumor that eating the flesh of the Tang monk grants immortality.
Yeah.
Eternal life.
So losing the kids is bad, but now...
Now he has a much, much bigger prize in mind. Forget the annual sacrifice. Capturing the Tang monk is the new goal. He's determined now.
But he's also worried. He just fought Monkey and Pigsy.
Yeah, he actually voices that doubt. He knows how strong those disciples are. He's thinking, how am I actually going to do this?
And that's when one of his followers steps up.
Right. A character described as a spotted mandarin fish elder, heir Binks King. She has an idea. She asks the king first, can you make it snow? Can you freeze things?
And the king's like, yeah, of course I can.
Oh, yeah. He boasts about it, says he can make it snow, and crucially, he can freeze the entire river solid.
Okay, so what's the plan?
It's pretty cunning, actually, she lays it out. First, at midnight, the king uses his power to whip up a freezing wind, heavy snow, and freeze the whole surface of the Tuntina River, make it look like solid ground.
Step one, freeze the river. Got it.
Step two, deception. Some of the other water creatures will disguise themselves as humans, you know, carrying bundles, pushing carts, looking like ordinary travelers.
They'll walk on the ice.
Exactly. They'll walk back and forth over and over again, making it look safe and busy.
Why? What's the point of that?
To lure the Tang monk. The elder knows the monk is super eager to get to the west, to continue his journey. If he sees people crossing this massive frozen river,
he'll think it's a safe shortcut.
Precisely. He'll likely insist they all walk across the ice instead of waiting to find a boat or another way, exploiting his piety and eagerness.
Oh, okay, that's clever. And the final step, the trap.
The trap. The king himself will wait hidden under the ice, right over the deepest part of the channel. When the monk and his disciples are walking right above him,
smash!
He shatters the ice from below. They all fall into the freezing water, disoriented, probably weighed down, and completely at his mercy. Easy capture.
Wow, that is quite a plan. What does the king think?
He loves it. The text says his reaction is, oh shoot, utterly brilliant, utterly brilliant. He's totally sold and immediately goes off to start the freezing process.
Before dawn,
yeah.
Inside the Chen family's house where they're staying.
Yes, and right away the text tells you how incredibly cold it is, even indoors.
It says they're under heavy quilts, but get this, no warmth.
Yeah, and their hands in their sleeves feel like they're holding ice. That's pretty severe for being inside.
You can almost feel it. And, okay, no surprise here, who complains first?
Slight chuckle.
It's gotta be Pigsy. Just a simple cold.
Classic Pigsy. Always a physical comfort.
But then Monkey jumps in with his usual attitude. Sort of dismissive.
Oh, yeah. What does he say?
Something like chininol. Basically, monastics like us aren't bothered by heat or cold. You know, trying to sound tough.
Right, like he's above it all. Or maybe just likes giving Pigsy a hard time.
Probably a bit of both.
Yeah.
But here's the interesting bit. Tripitaka, the master.
Yeah. You'd think he'd side with Monkey, maybe. On the spiritual discipline front.
But he doesn't. He actually agrees with Pigsy. And that tells you, wow, this cold must be really bad if even the master acknowledges it so plainly.
Okay, yeah, that lends it some serious weight.
And then Tripitaka launches into this almost poetic description of what the cold is doing outside, which they can sense from inside. It's quite something.
Y'all, what? What does he describe?
Well, things like Toki Sonzan decaying leaves are tipped with frost.
And the pine trees have, like, frozen bells hanging off them. And even the ground itself is cracking because the cold is so extreme.
Cracking? Wow.
And the pond surface is frozen solid. It's painting a picture of intense, deep cold.
He even says they are shivering all over like little bells. So the text isn't just saying it's cold. It's making you feel it through these details.
Exactly. It establishes the harshness of the environment right from the start, even before they see the snow. It kind of primes you.
Which they do see next, right? Because it's just too cold inside anyway.
Precisely. They get up, get dressed, open the door, and bam. Outside, it's just this vast white expanse. It's been snowing.
And not just a little bit, I gather.
Oh, no. The text really goes to town describing this snow. It uses incredibly rich language.
Give us some examples. What's it like?
Well, the sky is, dense, reddish clouds, heavy, gloomy fog everywhere. There's a wind, too.
A cold one, I bet.
A biting north wind. Air howling.
Mm-hmm.
And the snow itself is tisier, great, heavy snow falling, just covering everything.
Sounds intense.
And then you get these beautiful poetic terms for snow. It calls snowflakes six-petaled flowers.
Oh, that's nice.
And describes the falling snow as achek, like pieces of flying jade. Every branch is like eche, like it's adorned with jade.
Flying jade. Wow.
And it piles up incredibly fast. Eche kicks bread like it turns from powder to salt almost instantly.
That's a striking image. Powder turning to salt really conveys the volume and speed.
It does. And then it gets even more dramatic. It talks about white parrots losing their color against the snow, matching the white cranes.
So just overwhelming whiteness.
And then that line, the famous one, H-A.
Which means?
It means the snowstorm looks like it's battled and defeated 3 million jade dragons. It's this epic metaphor for swirling, powerful snow.
3 million jade dragons. That turns a snowstorm into something mythical, almost violent.
Absolutely. And it follows up with fluteng, like broken scales and shattered armor flying everywhere. It's portraying the snow as this immense, powerful force.
So beautiful, but also kind of terrifying.
Yes. It transforms the whole landscape. Bridges are covered like with willow catkins, houses like with pear blossoms. Chutin. Picturesque, but also concealing.
And it affects people directly.
Definitely. Travelers can't get wine. Servants struggle to find plum blossoms. Simple tasks become hard. And crucially, the roads are obscured, impassable.
So it's not just pretty. It's a real obstacle.
A huge one. The text even mentions famous historical figures known for enduring cold winters.
Like who?
Names like Yuan An, Sun Kang, Su Wu. But thinks as essentially, this snow is way worse than anything they faced.
Huh. So it's using literary references just to say how unusually bad this storm is.
Exactly. It really drives home that this is extreme.
Yeah.
But then, amidst all this, the Chen family steps up.
Right. They're hosts. What do?
They show amazing hospitality. They're out there clearing paths, bringing hot water for washing, hot tea, food, lots of food mentioned, like rolled cakes, gruel, breakfast, lunch.
Even in this weather.
Yes. And charcoal to keep them warm. Really generous.
That kindness stands out against the harshness, doesn't it?
It really does. It's a recurring theme, that contrast. But while they're being cared for, Tripitaka is bothered by something fundamental.
About the weather itself.
Yeah. He asked Chen Lao, the head of the family, if this region has four seasons like back home in the upper country, the capital.
And does it?
Chen Lao says yes, they have seasons, just like Tang China.
Okay. So what's Tripitaka's confusion then?
His question is basically, if you have normal seasons, why on earth is there such heavy snow and intense cold now?
The timing seems off to him.
Completely off. And Chen Lao explains, well, it's the seventh month, but yesterday was the white dew solar term, so technically it's the start of the eighth month period now.
Cool.
Okay, so early autumn, maybe, still seems early for this kind of snow. That's what Tripitaka thinks. But then Chen Lao drops the crucial piece of information. He says, very casually,
meaning, around here, we always get frost and snow in the eighth month. It happens every year.
Whoa. Okay, that's the reveal.
Exactly. For Tripitaka, coming from the eastern land, this is bizarre. He says back home, snow only comes Sadala when winter proper arrives.
So they've traveled so far west that the whole climate pattern is different. An early harsh winter is just normal here.
It's a massive geographical marker. They are truly in a different world now, climatically speaking.
And how does Tripitaka react to this realization and the snow piling up? The text says it gets deep fast, right?
Yeah, quickly reaches about 2 feet deep on level ground. And Tripitaka, well, he gets upset.
Upset how?
The text says he becomes anxious, even starts shedding tears.
Tears over snow. Why such a strong reaction?
He explains why. It all comes down to the mission. He remembers his promise to the Tang Emperor.
The promise to return in 3 years.
Yeah.
That was the original deadline.
Oh. And how long has it actually been?
He says, Horfun. It's already been 7 or 8 years.
Oh, wow. Okay, I see the problem. He's massively overdue.
Hugely. He's terrified of breaking the imperial deadline.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, he says they still face fierce demons ahead.
Right. The journey's far from over.
Last night, disciples did us a small favor, and his immediate plan right there was to find a boat to cross the nearby river and keep moving.
But the snow
has made the roads impassable. They're stuck. His whole plan is derailed, threatening the mission's success. It's fascinating. His breakdown isn't facing a monster. It's this very real, very human stress about delays and deadlines.
That makes him feel very relatable, actually. Grounded.
It does. And Chen Lao sees this distress. He tries to comfort him.
What does he say?
Basically, hey, after 7 or 8 years already, what's a few more days? Don't worry about it. But then he makes a huge promise. He says once the weather clears and the ice melts, he will help them get across that river, even if it costs him his entire family fortune. It heavily implies the disciples rescued the family, likely from that river demon mentioned in the chapter title. And the hospitality continues. More meals, very generous. Tripitaka feels a bit awkward about it.
Yeah, he asks them to tone it down.
He says, just treat us simply, like family. But Chen Lao insists.
He says no.
He says, even if we feasted you every single day, it would be hard to repay you properly for saving us.
Which is nice, gives them a breather. And even in this forced downtime, they find something, right? Chen Lao suggests, hey, let's go check out the garden.
Even though it's freezing cold.
Yeah. And Pigsy, ever the pragmatist, he's immediately like, are you kidding? A garden? In this weather, what's the point?
Which, you know, is a fair reaction. It's cold. But the source sort of pushes back a bit. Monkey points out that snowy landscapes have their own kind of quiet beauty.
And Chen Lao agrees, right. It's about finding a different kind of appreciation, maybe some tranquility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when they do go out, the garden actually is pretty stunning. The source uses these really lovely descriptions.
Oh, yeah, like the pines bearing jade blossoms.
Yes. And willows hung with silver flowers. It paints this picture of everything coated in ice and snow, looking almost like jewels.
And the fish pond is frozen solid like an ice disc. Even the buildings, the pavilions are covered in snow. Nature doing its own sort of temporary art installation.
It really is. And then Chen Lao takes him somewhere even more special, this place called the Snow Cave.
Okay, what's that?
It sounds like this cozy refuge built specifically to be warm inside the cold garden area. Little haven.
Oh, nice. Like a warm little bubble. The description sounds great. There's a beast-faced, elephant-footed copper fire basin.
Mm-hmm. Giving off warmth. And comfy tiger skin chairs, paper windows, letting in that soft, snowy light.
Cozy.
Very. And the art inside. It's not just random pictures. The paintings seem chosen to resonate with their journey.
Right, like the seven sages crossing the pass, that fits. And fishing in a cold river. Images of endurance, maybe contemplation.
Exactly. And even historical scenes like Su Wu eating felt.
Ah, story of loyalty and exile.
Right. And breaking off plum branches to meet an envoy about connection despite hardship. These aren't just pretty pictures. They feel like subtle reminders of perseverance, of finding ways through obstacles.
That's interesting layering.
Yeah, and the source even includes these lines that emphasize the setting, contrasting how easy it is to get fish near a water pavilion versus how hard it is to buy wine on a snowy mountain path.
Highlighting the comfort of their little cave compared to the harshness outside and the journey still ahead.
Precisely. So they're in this warm kind of reflective space, having tea, well, plain wine for the disciples, chatting with neighbors, enjoying this brief pause. A moment of calm.
But that calm doesn't last, does it, as evening comes?
Nope. The big news breaks. They overhear villagers talking outside. And it's pretty shocking news.
What is it?
The Tomtian River, this massive river on their route. It's frozen. Completely solid.
Wow. Not just the edges.
No, the source is very specific. It says, the 800 light are all frozen like a mirror.
800 light? That's, what, like 400 kilometers? A huge stretch of river, just solid ice.
Immense. Totally impassable by boat, obviously. And this hits Tripitaka hard. He's immediately worried, asking Monkey, you know, how on earth do we get across this?
Yeah, that's a major obstacle.
Little Mr. Chen, their host.
Hmm?
He initially hopes maybe it's just the shallow parts near the bank.
Wishful thinking.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Because a traveler quickly confirms it. The whole river, top to bottom, bank to bank, frozen solid. And people are already walking on it.
People are walking across this giant frozen river.
That's what they hear. And the next day, they go down to the riverbank to see for themselves. And there they are. Streams of people just walking across the ice.
Who are these people? Why are they doing that? It sounds incredibly dangerous.
Well, this is where the story gives us a really sharp look at human motivation. Chen Lao explains they're merchants.
Merchants going where?
They're trading with the woman land of Western Liang. And the reason they're risking it, profit. Massive profit.
Don't mess.
The source gives figures. It says something like 100 cash worth of goods here is worth 10,000 there. And vice versa.
100-fold return. Wow, no wonder they're tempted.
Exactly. It's described as profit-heavy, capital-light. Normally, they risk dangerous boat journeys for this trade. The frozen rivers is a different kind of risk, but the potential payoff is just enormous. So they take the chance.
Seeing these people risk everything for money, that must have made Tripitaka think.
It definitely did. It sparks this really significant moment of reflection for him. He watches them, risking death for profit.
And what does he conclude?
He comes out with this big statement. In worldly matters, only fame and profit are most important.
Fame and profit, that's quite a statement. Does he mean just for others or?
Well, that's the fascinating part. He immediately turns it back on himself. He compares those merchants risking death for profit to his own journey.
How so?
He says he's serving the emperor, undertaking this incredibly hard, dangerous pilgrimage for fame.
Fame.
But the core idea is he sees a parallel. He sees himself also driven by something huge, something that justifies immense risk, just like the merchants are driven by profit.
So is he saying they're basically the same drive, just for different rewards?
The story kind of leaves it hanging there,
yeah.
But it strongly suggests that these ultimate goals, huge wealth, huge recognition or achievement, are maybe two sides of the same coin. Powerful, life-risking motivators.
Okay, so Tripitaka sees the frozen river, sees people crossing. What's his reaction for their journey?
He sees it as an opportunity. He wants to cross now, immediately.
Seize the day.
Pretty much. But Xiemeng steps in. He's the voice of caution here.
Okay, what's his argument?
He uses this great idiom, something like, 1,000 days eat 1,000 measures of rice. Basically saying, look, we've been guests long enough. We appreciate the hospitality. We're eager to go, but...
But let's not be stupid about it.
Exactly. Safety first. He argues they should wait. Wait for the ice to melt, cross properly by boat like they normally would.
Makes sense. Don't trust this freak occurrence.
Yeah, and he uses another saying, hearing is not as good as seeing. Meaning, just because we hear people are crossing or even see a few doing it, doesn't mean it's actually safe for us with our horse and luggage. Have we really checked it out properly?
That's very sensible. The classic dilemma, right? Jump on the unexpected opportunity or stick with the tried and tested, safer way?
It really is, and Tripitaka pushes back against waiting. His argument is pure practicality.
What does he say?
He points out the time of year. It's the 8th month in the lunar calendar that's late autumn heading into winter.
Ah, so it's not going to get warmer anytime soon.
Right. It's only going to get colder, waiting for a natural spring thaw like in the 2nd or 3rd month. That would mean waiting for maybe half a year.
Half a year delay. Ouch. That's a huge chunk of their journey, time lost.
Exactly. So waiting isn't really practical if they want to keep making progress. The calendar is working against Xiemeng's cautious approach.
So you've got Tripitaka saying, go now, it's a sign. Xiemeng saying, wait, be safe. And the clock ticking. How do they decide?
Well, this is where Pigsy comes in. He breaks the deadlock with a very Pigsy solution.
Oh, boy. What does he suggest?
He proposes testing the ice.
Okay. Oh.
Not testing the depth, like finding out how deep the water is.
Right.
Testing the strength of the ice itself, its thickness.
And how does he plan to do that? Throw a rock.
Not quite. His method is a bit more direct. He's going to hit it with his 9-tooth rake.
He's going to hit the ice with his giant rake.
Yep. His logic is simple. If the rake breaks through, the ice is too thin. If it doesn't...
It's thick enough. Okay, that's direct, forceful.
Very Pigsy. And the source says he lifts this heavy rake with both hands and brings it down on the ice with all his might, a full power swing.
What happens? Does it shatter?
Not at all. The impact is huge. It leaves 9 white marks on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
But the ice holds completely firm.
Wow.
In fact, the impact is so solid that Pigsy's own hands are left painfully numb or aching from the jolt.
So the force that hurt him barely scratched the ice.
Pretty much. His own pain becomes the proof of the ice's incredible strength. He immediately declares it safe. He shouts, can go, even the bottom is solidified.
Ah, okay.
And he immediately starts getting ready to leave the Chen.
It's the Chen family. Did they try to keep the pilgrims longer? How did the send-off go?
Oh, they definitely wanted them to stay. But seeing the pilgrims were set on leaving, the elders prepared provisions.
Food for the road.
Exactly. Roasted dried food, baked goods like flatbread and steamed buns. And as a sign of real gratitude for saving the village and their children, they brought out this whole plate piled high with scattered gold and silver, knelt down and offered it to them.
Wow, that's a very generous offering. But Tang Sanzang, he's a monk on a mission. How does he respond to the money?
He refuses it, flat out, shakes his head, says something like, what use are riches to this poor monk? I wouldn't even dare carry it.
Great.
Our true practice is to live by begging. The dried food is more than enough. Sticks to his principles, you know.
Yeah.
Detachment from wealth.
So the silver is refused, but Wukong steps in here, doesn't he? Always the pragmatist.
Precisely. Wukong, seeing the elders really want to give something, he subtly pinches off just a tiny piece with his fingertip. Only about 4 or 5 key, like nothing really.
The tiny amount.
Yeah. Hands it to Tang Sanzang and suggests, Master, just take this. A bit of pin money, a small contribution. Don't completely ignore the elders' kindness. It's a little compromise, right?
Yeah.
Honors the host without burdening the master.
That's a smart move by Wukong. Okay, so they take the dried food, that tiny token of silver, say their goodbyes, and head straight for the ice. Now, given Baji's assessment, you'd expect it to be smooth sailing.
You would think so.
But trouble starts almost immediately, doesn't it?
The moment they step onto the ice, the white horse slips, bang, nearly throws Tang Sanzang right off.
Whoa.
It's a stark contrast to Baji's confidence just moments before.
Wow. Yeah, that initial slip really shatters the confidence. Who points out the obvious problem?
That's just saying. Seeing the struggle, he immediately says, Master, this is hard to walk. The reality of just how slippery it is hits them.
So Baji's test, maybe it showed thickness, but not the surface condition. How do they solve this slipping problem then?
This is where Baji actually shows some surprising practical know-how. He calls out, hold on, ask the Chen elder for some straw.
Straw? What's straw gonna do on ice?
Wukong wonders the same thing, but Baji explains, you haven't walked on ice before. You need to wrap the horse's hooves with straw, then it won't slip. Keep the master from falling.
Wrapping hooves in straw for traction, that's incredibly resourceful, like real folk wisdom. You wouldn't expect that from a former heavenly marshal, maybe.
Exactly. And the elder on the shore hears this, quickly sends someone for a bundle of straw. Tang Sanzang goes back to the bank, gets off the horse.
Oh, okay.
And Baji wraps the horse's feet. Simple, but apparently effective.
So the horse has better grip now? Is that the only precaution Baji suggests? Any other ice travel tips?
No, he adds another layer of safety. After wrapping the hooves, he gives his own rake, staff, sorry, keeps getting mixed up. He gives his 9-ringed staff to Tang Sanzang and tells him, Master, hold this horizontally while you're on the horse.
Hold it horizontally? That sounds awkward. Why?
Wukong thinks he's just being lazy, right? Trying to get out of carrying it.
Exactly. Wukong suspects laziness. But Baji has a very specific, very practical reason. He explains, look, wherever there's thick ice, there are always ice eyes.
Ice eyes, like thin spots.
Yes, potential thin spots or holes.
Yeah.
If you step into one and fall through, and you're not holding something horizontal, you'll just plunge straight down. It'll be like a big pot lid covering you, trapped. How would you get back up?
Wow.
You must hold something horizontally, he says, to sort of bridge the opening.
So the horizontal staff acts like a safety bar, catches you on the edges if you fall through a weak spot. That's genuinely brilliant. It shows a deep understanding of the unique dangers.
It really is. And the text even notes Wukong's reaction. He secretly laughs, thinking, huh, this Baji is actually quite the seasoned ice walker.
Huh. So they all follow his advice. Tang Sanzang holds the staff, Wukong his iron rod, Shisang his demon subduing staff. Even Baji has his rake positioned horizontally while he manages the luggage. They finally seem to respect his expertise here.
Okay, equipped with straw shoes for the horse and safety bars, how does the journey across the ice actually proceed now?
Well, they continue across the ice for several light Chinese miles. This isn't a quick crossing. It takes them through the night.
All night on the ice. Wow.
Yes, the sources say they travel by the light of the stars and moon. The ice itself is described as shining brightly and vast and white. Just this huge expanse.
Must have been incredible. And cold.
Incredibly cold, yeah.
Yeah.
They travel fast, pushing on, horse never stopping its hooves, as the text says. None of them can really sleep. In the morning, they eat some of the dried food and just keep heading west.
So a long, cold, continuous effort. And then, after all this travel, they hear something alarming.
Yes. Suddenly there's this loud cracking sound. Yerch again, but this time from beneath the ice. Really loud. It frightens the horse.
Oh, no. A terrifying sound coming from underfoot. Tang Sanzang must have been scared. What does he ask?
He cries out, "Disciples, why is it making such a loud noise?" Understandably freaked out.
And how does Baji explain the sound? Is he still insisting the ice is totally solid?
He is, yeah. He basically doubles down. He attributes the noise to the sheer thickness of the ice. Calls it the earth ice cracking sound.
Earth ice cracking.
Yeah, he says something like, this river is frozen too solid. It's the earth ice cracking. Maybe it's even frozen solid all the way to the bottom right here. He's sticking to his guns.
Trying to rationalize it, maybe. How does Tang Sanzang react to that explanation?
The text says he's both startled and pleased. Startled by the noise, maybe. But pleased by Baji's explanation that suggests the ice is incredibly strong.
Huh. Okay.
So he urges the horse forward. Let's keep going.
And this is the critical moment, isn't it? That sound wasn't just natural ice cracking.
It was not. The source makes it crystal clear. The monster, the king of spiritual perception, remember him. He'd retreated to his underwater palace earlier.
Right.
He was actually waiting under the ice with all his followers, hiding down there.
So the sound was the monster setting a trap. What happens?
Exactly. The text says the monster from below used a magical trick to suddenly and violently burst open the ice. Each shot. It wasn't natural. It was a deliberate magical attack.
An ambush. What happens the instant the ice breaks open?
It's immediate chaos.
Yeah.
Catastrophic. The white horse falls straight into the water. Tang Sanzang, Baji, Sha Seng, they're all thrown off.
Oh my goodness.
Wukong, luckily, reacts instantly. Leaps into the air, gets clear.
So Tang Sanzang, the horse, the luggage, all plunge into the freezing water. Wukong safe in the air. What about Baji and Sha Seng?
They seem to get thrown off, but avoid the initial plunge directly into the hole, maybe. But the main thing is Tang Sanzang is in the water. And the monster acts fast.
Grabs him.
Seizes Tang Sanzang and leads its whole group of followers straight back down to its underwater palace.
Oh,
gone.
Just like that. Captured. Taken deep into the monster's lair. What's the first thing the monster does when it gets back down there?
It calls out for its associate. Where is Old Perch Woman? Calls her. Ick.
The Old Perch Woman arrives. How does she greet the monster king?
With what seems like excessive politeness,
yeah,
a bit fawning, greets him at the door with a bow, saying, "Your Majesty, I wouldn't dare, I wouldn't dare."
Okay. And what is the monster's immediate plan for Tang Sanzang? It sounds pretty gruesome in the text.
It is. Straight to the point and brutal. The monster orders his minions, "Bring the table, sharpen the knives, cut this monk open, scoop out his heart, skin him, slice his flesh."
Jeez.
Calls for music, too. And clearly states his goal. Eat him with the Old Perch Woman to gain longevity. Extend their lives.
He wants to carve him up right away. Does the Old Perch Woman just go along with this?
No, actually. She offers some cunning, strategic advice. She suggests they wait. Hold on for a couple of days, she says.
Why wait?
Her reasoning is practical. She fears the disciples Wukong and the others might come looking for their master right away and cause a big fight.
Ah, avoid immediate confrontation. Smart.
Yeah. She advises that then, after a couple of days, once they see if the coast is clear, then they can eat him properly. More leisurely, make a real feast of it with all the monster's family present, music, the whole deal, a secure celebration.
That's disturbingly sensible advice from the villain's side. Does the monster listen to her?
Yes. The text says Tang Sanzang is spared immediate carving. Where do they stash him while they wait?
He's hidden away, behind the main palace area. The source is specific. They put him inside a 6-foot-long stone box.
A stone box?
Yeah, like a stone coffin or chest. 6 feet long. Put the lid on top. He's secured, hidden, just waiting.
Trapped in a stone box at the bottom of a freezing river?
Yeah.
Wow. Meanwhile, back at surface, what about Baji and Sha Seng? They were thrown off when the ice broke. Right. They end up in the icy water, but they react quickly. They manage to fish out the luggage.
Okay, save that.
Put it onto the white horse, who's also in the water, and then somehow they manage to get themselves out of the water.
Wait, just like that? Out of the freezing river after that chaos? How?
This is where their unique backgrounds become absolutely crucial. The text explains how they do it. It says they parted the water channels, churned the waves, and basically carried the luggage out.
Because
of who they are. Baji, remember, was originally Marshal Tianpeng. He commanded 80,000 Heavenly River soldiers. Water's his element, in a way.
Right, right.
Sulsing. He came from the Liushi River, lived in water for ages. And the White Horse.
He's not just a horse.
He's actually a dragon prince from the West Sea.
Yeah.
Water is literally his home turf.
So their past lives, their true natures, basically equip them perfectly to survive this exact disaster. That's amazing.
It really is. Two former water deities and a dragon. Exactly who you'd want if the ice breaks.
Makes perfect sense. And Wukong, who flew up. What's he doing?
Wukong's overhead, in the air, guiding them. Directs them back to the east bank, the side they started from.
So they all make it back to solid ground. What's the first thing they do?
They get themselves and the horse dried off, shake out their clothes, brush down the horse. Wukong lands, joins them, and then the three of them head back to the Chen family village.
Oh, boy. Back to the Chen family. How do the villagers react when they see only three pilgrims return, soaked to the bone?
Someone spots them immediately and runs to tell the elders. Hey, those four masters who left, only three came back. The elders are, you know, shocked, concerned.
And when the elders meet them, what's that exchange like?
They rush out, see their wet clothes, and they're full of sorrow. Regret, too. They basically say, Masters, we tried so hard to get you to stay, but you wouldn't listen. You insisted on leaving, and now look what happened. They feel like their warnings were ignored.
Sounds like they assume Tang Sanzang is dead, and Baji. He makes a grim joke here, doesn't he? Classic Baji.
He does. When they ask about the master, Baji says something like, Oh, he's not called Sanzang anymore. His name's changed to Chen Gone to the Bottom.
Chen Gone to the Bottom. A dark pun on the family name and sinking. Oof. How do the elders take that?
They're just filled with grief. Lamenting. Pitiable. Pitiable. We said, wait for the thaw, we'll get you a boat. But you stubbornly refused, and now he's lost his life. They're completely convinced he's dead.
But Wukong steps in. He knows his master's not gone that easily, right?
He does. Wukong tells the elders, basically, hey, don't worry about him. My master is hard to kill. He's got, like, plot armor. Well, not plot armor, but he says, Ijyu, implying he won't die here, not yet. He has faith.
And Wukong immediately knows who's behind it all. He seems to recognize the villain.
Oh, yeah. He pegs the culprit right away. Declares, your grandson knows. It was definitely that king of spiritual perception who used magic to scheme and grab him. He names the monster.
So Wukong knows the enemy. Does he have a plan? What does he tell the Chen family to do?
First, he takes care of the practical stuff. Tells the Chen family not to worry. Asks them to wash and starch their clothes, dry out the all-important travel document.
The passport, yeah. Crucial.
And feed the white horse. Get him sorted out.
Okay. And what's the bigger plan? Regarding the monster and rescuing the master.
Wukong's objective is twofold. Rescue the master, yes, but also ensure lasting peace for this village that helped them. He promises the elders that he and his brothers will find the monster, rescue Tang Sanzang, and in his words, cut the grass and remove the roots.
And eliminate the monster completely.
Exactly. Get rid of the threat entirely. His stated purpose is to remove all future trouble for the entire village, ensuring they can live in lasting peace. It's a big promise.
That's a powerful promise. Not just a rescue, but solving their long-term problem, too. How do the Chen elders react to that?
They are, as the text says, filled with happiness, overjoyed hearing this plan. They immediately arrange for food and supplies for the disciples before they set off.
So the stage is set. The three disciples get refreshed, leave the horse and the crucial luggage safely with the grateful Chen family,
right,
and prepare to go confront this underwater monster.
Exactly. After they eat, they entrust their gear, grab their weapons, and head straight back towards the river, ready to find their master and capture the monster. The text ends this part with
couplet, right? Kind of summarizing the deeper meaning.
Mistakenly stepping on layered ice damages one's true nature. How can a leaking great elixir be made whole?